identical to a bad argument used by many religious fundamentalists. Whereas the fundamentalists sometimes begin their arguments by saying, if God had intended man to fly, wear clothes, drink alcohol, the social Darwinists begin theirs by saying, in effect, if Mother Nature had intended man to, and even though Mother Nature, natural selection, can be viewed as having intentions, in the limited sense of having retrospectively endorsed features for one reason or another, these earlier endorsements may count for nothing now, since circumstances have changed. Among the social Darwinist ideas was a political agenda. Efforts by do-gooders to provide nurture for the least fortunate members of society are counterproductive. Such efforts permit those to replicate whom nature would wisely cull. These are abominable ideas, but they were not the primary target of Nietzsche's criticism. His primary target was the historical naivete of the social Darwinists, Hoy, 1986. Their Panglossian optimism about the ready adaptability of human reason, or prudence, to morality. Nietzsche saw their complacency as part of their heritage as English psychologists, intellectual descendants of Hume. He noted their desire to avoid skyhooks. These English psychologists, what do they really want? One always discovers them, seeking the truly effective and directing agent, that which has been decisive in its evolution, in just that place where the intellectual pride of man would least desire to find it, in the vis inertia of habit, for example, or in forgetfulness, or in a blind and chance mechanistic hooking together of ideas, or in something purely passive, automatic, reflexive, molecular, and thoroughly stupid. What is it really that always drives these psychologists in just this direction? Is it a secret, malicious, vulgar, perhaps self-deceiving instinct for belittling man? Nietzsche, 1887, First Essay, Section 1, page 24. Nietzsche's antidote to the banalities of the English psychologists was a very continental romanticism. They thought the passage from the state of nature to morality was easy, or at least quite presentable. But that was because they just made up their stories and didn't bother looking at the clues of history, which told a darker tale. Nietzsche began, as Hobbes had done, by imagining a pre-moral world of human life. But he divided his story of transition into two phases and told his tales in reverse order, starting in the middle, something that confuses many readers. Hobbes had noted, 1651, Part 1, Chapter 14, that the very existence of any practice of forming contracts or compacts depends on the capacity of human beings to make promises about the future. And what struck Nietzsche was that this capacity does not come for free. This was the topic of the second essay of the three that make up the genealogy. To breed an animal with the right to make promises. Is not this the paradoxical task that nature has set itself in the case of man? Is it not the real problem regarding man? Second essay, section 1, page 57. This long story of how responsibility originated is a story of how early human beings learned to torture each other, literally, into developing a special kind of memory, the memory needed to keep track of debts and credits, buying and selling, together with their psychological appurtenances, are older even than the beginnings of any kind of social forms of organization and alliances. Second essay, section 8, page 70. The capacity to detect cheating, to remember the promise broken and punish the cheater, had to be drilled into our ancestors' brains, Nietzsche surmised. Its beginnings were like the beginnings of everything great on earth, soaked in blood thoroughly and for a long time. Second essay, section 6, page 65. What is Nietzsche's evidence for all this? An imaginative, not to say unbridled, reading of what we might call the fossil record of human culture, in the form of ancient myths, surviving religious practices, archaeological clues, and so forth. Leaving the gory details aside, fascinating though they are, Nietzsche's suggestion is that eventually, perhaps via an instance of the Baldwin effect, our ancestors bred an animal with an innate capacity to keep a promise, and a concomitant talent for detecting and punishing a promise breaker. This permitted the formation of early societies, according to Nietzsche. But there was still no morality, not in the sense that we recognize and honor today. The second transition occurred in historical times, he claimed, and can be traced via etymological reconstruction and a proper reading of the texts of the last two millennia, an adaptation by Nietzsche of the philological methods that he had been trained to use. To read these clues in a new way, you need a theory, of course, and Nietzsche had one, developed in opposition to the tacit theory he discerned in the social Darwinists. The proto-citizens of Nietzsche's second just-so story, told in the first essay, live in societies of sorts, not Hobbes's state of nature, but the life he describes in them is about equally nasty and brutish. Might made right, or rather, might ruled. The people had concepts of good and bad, but not good and evil, right and wrong. Like Hobbes, Nietzsche tried to tell the tale of how these latter memes arose. One of the most daring and ultimately least persuasive of his speculations is that the memes for moral, good, and evil were not just minor permutations of their amoral predecessors. The memes traded places. What had been good, old style, became evil, new style. And what had been bad, old style, became morally good, new style. This transvaluation of values was, for Nietzsche, the key event in the birth of ethics, and he explicitly opposed it to Herbert Spencer's bland supposition that the concept good is essentially identical with the concept useful, practical, so that in the judgments good and bad, mankind has summed up and sanctioned precisely its unforgotten and unforgettable experiences regarding what is useful practical and what is harmful impractical. According to this theory, that which has always proved itself useful is good. Therefore, it may claim to be valuable in the highest degree, valuable in itself. This road to an explanation is, as aforesaid, also a wrong one, but at least the explanation is in itself reasonable and psychologically tenable. First essay, section 3, page 27. The amazing and ingenious tale Nietzsche told about how the transvaluation of values happened defies fair summary and is often outrageously misrepresented. I will not attempt to do justice to it here, but will just draw attention to its central theme, without judging its truth. The aristocrats who ruled by might over the weak were cunningly tricked by the priests into adopting the inverted values, and this slave revolt in morality turned the cruelty of the strong against itself, so that the strong were manipulated into subduing and civilizing themselves. For with the priests, everything becomes more dangerous. Not only cures and remedies, but also arrogance, revenge, acuteness, profligacy, love, lust to rule, virtue, disease. But it is only fair to add that it was on the soil of this essentially dangerous form of human existence, the priestly form, that man first became an interesting animal. That only here did the human soul in a higher sense acquire depth and become evil. And these are the two basic respects in which man has hitherto been superior to other beasts. First essay, section 6, page 33. Nietzsche's just-so stories are terrific, old style and new style. They are a mixture of brilliant and crazy, sublime and ignoble, devastatingly acute history and untrammeled fantasy. If Darwin's imagination was to some degree handicapped by his English mercantile heritage, Nietzsche's was even more handicapped by his German intellectual heritage. But those biographical facts, whatever they are, have no bearing on the current value of the memes whose birth each attended so brilliantly. Both came up with dangerous ideas. If I am right, this is no coincidence. But whereas Darwin was ultra-cautious in his expression, Nietzsche indulged in prose so overheated that it no doubt serves him right that his legion of devotees has included a disreputable gaggle of unspeakable and uncomprehending Nazis and other such fans whose perversions of his memes make Spencer's perversions of Darwin's seem almost innocent. In both cases, we must work to repair the damage such descendants have inflicted on our meme filters, which tend to dismiss memes on the basis of guilt by association. Neither Darwin nor Nietzsche was politically correct, fortunately for us. Political correctness, in the extreme versions worthy of the name, is antithetical to almost all surprising advances in thought. We might call it eumemics, since it is, like the extreme eugenics of the social Darwinists, an attempt to impose myopically derived standards of safety and goodness on the bounty of nature. Few today, but there are a few, would brand all genetic counseling, all genetic policies, with the condemnatory title of eugenics. We should reserve that term of criticism for the greedy and peremptory policies, the extremist policies. In Chapter 18, we will consider how we might wisely patrol the memesphere and what we might do to protect ourselves from the truly dangerous ideas. But we should keep the bad example of eugenics firmly in mind when we do so. Nietzsche's most important contribution to sociobiology, I think, is his steadfast application of one of Darwin's own fundamental insights to the realm of cultural evolution. This is the insight most notoriously overlooked by the social Darwinists and by some contemporary sociobiologists. Their error is sometimes called the genetic fallacy, for example, Hoy, 1986. The mistake of inferring current function or meaning from ancestral function or meaning. As Darwin, 1862, page 284, put it, "Thus, throughout nature, almost every part of each living thing has probably served in a slightly modified condition for diverse purposes, and has acted in the living machinery of many ancient and distinct specific forms." And as Nietzsche put it, "The cause of the origin of a thing and its eventual utility, its actual employment and place in a system of purposes, lie worlds apart. Whatever exists, having somehow come into being, is again and again reinterpreted to new ends, taken over, transformed, and redirected by some power superior to it. All events in the organic world are a subduing, a becoming master, and all subduing and becoming master involves a fresh interpretation, an adaptation through which any previous meaning and purpose are necessarily obscured or even obliterated." Second Essay, Section 12, page 77. Aside from Nietzsche's characteristic huffing and puffing about some power subduing and becoming master, this is pure Darwin. Or, as Gould might put it, all adaptations are exaptations, in cultural evolution as well as in biological evolution. Nietzsche went on to emphasize another classical Darwinian theme. The evolution of a thing, a custom, an organ is thus by no means its progressus toward a goal, even less a logical progressus by the shortest route, and with the smallest expenditure of force, but a succession of more or less profound more or less mutually independent processes of subduing, plus the resistance they encounter, the attempts at transformation for the purpose of defense and reaction, and the results of successful counteractions. Second essay, section 12, pages 77 to 78. Considering that Nietzsche may never have read Darwin's own work, his appreciation of its major directions is remarkable. But he rather spoiled his record as a sound Darwinian by lapsing on the same page into skyhook hunger, announcing his fundamental opposition to the now prevalent instinct and taste, which would rather be reconciled even to the absolute fortuitousness, even the mechanistic senselessness of all events, than to a theory that in all events a will to power is operating. Nietzsche's idea of a will to power is one of the stranger incarnations of skyhook hunger, and fortunately few find it attractive today. But if we set that aside, the upshot of Nietzsche's genealogy of morals is that we must be extremely careful not to read into the history we extrapolate from nature any simplistic conclusions about value. The question, what is the value of this or that table of values and morals, should be viewed from the most diverse perspectives, for the problem, value for what, cannot be examined too subtly. Something, for example, that possessed obvious value in relation to the longest possible survival of a race, or to the enhancement of its power of adaptation to a particular climate, or to the preservation of the greatest number, would by no means possess the same value if it were a question, for instance, of producing a stronger type. The well-being of the majority and the well-being of the few are opposite viewpoints of value. To consider the former a priori of higher value may be left to the naivete of English biologists. Nietzsche, 1887, First Essay, Section 17. It is Spencer, clearly, not Darwin, whom Nietzsche is accusing of naivete about value. Both Spencer and Rhee thought they could see a straight, simple path to altruism. Hoy, 1986, page 29. We can see Nietzsche's criticism of this Panglossianism as a clear forerunner of George Williams's criticism of the Panglossianism of naive group selectionism. Listen to chapter 11. Spencer, in our terms, was an egregiously greedy reductionist, trying to derive ought from is in a single step. But doesn't this reveal the deeper problem with all sociobiology? Haven't the philosophers shown us that you can never derive ought from is, no matter how many steps you take? Some have argued that sociobiology, no matter how sophisticated it became, no matter how many cranes it employed, could never bridge the gap between the is of empirical scientific fact and the ought of ethics. They say this with impressive passion. That is the conviction we must examine next. 3. Some varieties of greedy ethical reductionism. One of the shibboleths of contemporary philosophy is that you can't derive ought from is. Attempting to do this is often called the naturalistic fallacy, taking the term from G.E. Moore's classic Principia Ethica, 1903. As the philosopher Bernard Williams points out, 1983, page 556, there really are several issues here. Naturalism consists in the attempt to lay down certain fundamental aspects of the good life for man on the basis of considerations of human nature. Naturalism wouldn't be refuted by the rather obvious fact that you can't derive any simple ought statement from any simple is statement. Consider, does it follow logically that I ought to give you $5 from the fact, and suppose it is a fact, that I said I would give you $5? Obviously not. Any number of intervening excusing conditions might be cited to block this inference, even if we were to characterize my saying as promising, an ethically loaded description. no simple ought statement follows directly. But reflections like this make scarcely a dent on naturalism as a theoretical goal. Philosophers distinguish between finding the necessary and sufficient conditions for various things, and the application of the distinction in this case actually helps clarify the situation. It is one thing to deny that collections of facts about the natural world are necessary to ground an ethical conclusion, and quite another to deny that any collection of such facts is sufficient. According to standard doctrine, if we stay firmly planted in the realm of facts about the world as it is, we will never find any collection of them, taken as axioms, from which any particular ethical conclusion can be conclusively proven. You can't get there from here, any more than you can get from any consistent set of axioms about arithmetic to all the true statements of arithmetic. Well, so what? We may bring out the force of this rhetorical question with another one, rather more pointed. If ought cannot be derived from is, just what can ought be derived from? Is ethics an entirely autonomous field of inquiry? Does it float untethered to facts from any other discipline or tradition? Do our moral intuitions arise from some inexplicable ethics module implanted in our brains, or our hearts, to speak with tradition? That would be a dubious skyhook on which to hang our deepest convictions about what is right and wrong. Colin McGinn notes, according to Chomsky, it is plausible to see our ethical faculty as analogous to our language faculty. We acquire ethical knowledge with very little explicit instruction, without great intellectual labor, and the end result is remarkably uniform given the variety of ethical input we receive. The environment serves merely to trigger and specialize an innate schematism. On the Chomskyan model, both science and ethics are natural products of contingent human psychology, constrained by its specific constitutive principles. But ethics looks to have a securer basis in our cognitive architecture. There is an element of luck to our possession of scientific knowledge that is absent in the case of our ethical knowledge. McGinn, 1993, page 30. By contrasting our presumed innate sense of ethical knowledge with our merely lucky capacity to engage in science, McGinn and Chomsky suggest that there are reasons to be discovered for our possession of the former. If there were a morality module, we would certainly want to know what it was, how it evolved, and, most important of all, why. But once again, if we try to peer inside, McGinn tries to close the door on our fingers, decrying as scientism the attempt to provide answers to our scientific questions about the source of this marvelous perspective we and no other creatures have. From what can ought be derived? The most compelling answer is this: ethics must be somehow based on an appreciation of human nature, on a sense of what a human being is or might be, and on what a human being might want to have or want to be. If that is naturalism, then naturalism is no fallacy. No one could seriously deny that ethics is responsive to such facts about human nature. We may just disagree about where to look for the most telling facts about human nature, in novels, in religious texts, in psychological experiments, in biological or anthropological investigations. The fallacy is not naturalism, but rather any simple-minded attempt to rush from facts to values. In other words, the fallacy is greedy reductionism of values to facts, rather than reductionism considered more circumspectly, as the attempt to unify our worldview so that our ethical principles don't clash irrationally with the way the world is. Most of the debates about the naturalistic fallacy are better interpreted as disagreements analogous to the skyhooks versus cranes debates in evolutionary theory. For instance, B.F. Skinner, in my estimation the world champion greedy reductionist of all time, wrote an ethical treatise of his own, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, 1971. In it, he committed the naturalistic fallacy on every scale, from the minute to the megalomaniacal. To make a value judgment by calling something good or bad is to classify it in terms of its reinforcing effects. Skinner, 1971, page 105. Let's see. That would mean that heroin is good, apparently, and taking care of elderly parents is bad? Is this objection just nitpicking a careless definition? The reinforcing effect of heroin, Skinner assures us when he notices the problem, page 110, is anomalous. Hardly a convincing defense against the charge of greedy reductionism. He goes on and on in the book about how scientific his design for a culture is, and how optimally suited it is for what? What is his characterization of the summum bonum? Our culture has produced the science and technology it needs to save itself. It has the wealth needed for effective action. It has, to a considerable extent, a concern for its own future. But if it continues to take freedom and dignity, rather than its own survival, as its principal value, then it is possible that some other culture will make a greater contribution in the future. Skinner, 1971, page 181. I hope you want to join me in retorting, so what? Even if Skinner were right, and surely he isn't, that a behaviorist regime is our best chance of preserving our culture into the future, I hope it is clear to you that Skinner may well have been mistaken when he deemed survival of the culture to be the highest goal any of us could ever imagine wanting to further. In Chapter 11, we briefly considered how mad it would be to put survival of one's own genes ahead of everything else. Is survival of one's own culture a clearly saner item to put on the pedestal above everything else? Would it justify mass murder, for instance, or betraying all your friends? We meme users can see other possibilities, beyond our genes, and beyond even the welfare of the groups and cultures to which we currently belong. Unlike our somatic line cells, we can conceive of more complicated raisons d'être. What is wrong with Skinner is not that he tried to base ethics on scientific facts about human nature, but that his attempt was so simplistic. I suppose pigeons might indeed fare as well as they ever could want in a Skinnerian utopia, but we are really much more complicated than pigeons. The same defect can be seen in the attempt at ethics by another Harvard professor, E.O. Wilson, one of the world's great entomologists and the coiner of the term sociobiology, 1975. In his ethical treatise, On Human Nature, 1978, Wilson, pages 196 and 198, faces the problem of identifying the summum bonum, or cardinal value, and comes up with two co-equals. In the beginning, the new ethicists will want to ponder the cardinal value of the survival of human genes in the form of a common pool over generations. I believe that a correct application of evolutionary theory also favors diversity in the gene pool as a cardinal value. Then, on page 199, he adds a third universal human rights, but suggests that it must be demythologized. A rational ant would find the ideal of human rights biologically unsound and the very concept of individual freedom intrinsically evil. We will accede to universal rights because power is too fluid in advanced technological societies to circumvent this mammalian imperative. The long-term consequences of inequity will always be visibly dangerous to its temporary beneficiaries. I suggest that this is the true reason for the universal rights movement, and that an understanding of its raw biological causation will be more compelling in the end than any rationalization contrived by culture to reinforce and euphemize it. E. Wilson, 1978, page 199. Writing in collaboration with the philosopher of biology, Michael Ruse, Wilson declares that sociobiology has shown us that morality, or more strictly our belief in morality, is merely an adaptation put in place to further our reproductive ends. Ruse and Wilson, 1985. Nonsense. Our reproductive ends may have been the ends that kept us in the running till we could develop culture, and they may still play a powerful, sometimes overpowering, role in our thinking. But that does not license any conclusion at all about our current values. It does not follow from the fact that our reproductive ends were the ultimate historical source of our present values, that they are the ultimate and still principal beneficiary of our ethical actions. If Ruse and Wilson think otherwise, they are committing the genetic fallacy Nietzsche and Darwin warned us about. As Nietzsche said, the cause of the origin of a thing and its eventual utility, its actual employment and place in a system of purposes, lie worlds apart. Do Ruse and Wilson commit this fallacy? Consider what else they say on the subject, on page 51. In an important sense, ethics as we understand it is an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate. Furthermore, the way our biology enforces its ends is by making us think that there is an objective higher code to which we are all subject. It must be true that there is an evolutionary explanation of how our memes and genes interacted to create the policies of human cooperation that we enjoy in civilization. We haven't figured out all the details yet, but it must be true unless there are skyhooks in the offing. But this would not show that the result was for the benefit of the genes, as principal beneficiaries. Once memes are on the scene, they, and the persons they help create, are also potential beneficiaries. Hence, the truth of an evolutionary explanation would not show that our allegiance to ethical principles or a higher code was an illusion. In a famous image, Wilson puts his vision this way. The genes hold culture on a leash. The leash is very long, but inevitably values will be constrained in accordance with their effects on the human gene pool. E. Wilson, 1978, page 167. But all this means, unless it is just false, is that in the long run, if we adopt cultural practices that have disastrous effects on the human gene pool, then the human gene pool will succumb. There is no reason to think, however, that evolutionary biology shows us that our genes are powerful enough and insightful enough to keep us from making policies quite antithetical to their interests. On the contrary, evolutionary thinking shows us that our genes could hardly be smarter than the engineers who designed our imagined survival machines, as we discussed in Chapter 14. And look how helpless they were in the face of unanticipatable collaborations with other robots. We have seen examples of parasites, such as viruses, that manipulate the behavior of their hosts to further their interests instead of the host's own interests. And we have seen examples of commensals and mutualists that join to make common cause, creating a larger beneficiary out of parts. Persons, according to the meme model we have sketched, are just such larger, higher entities, and the policies they come to adopt as a result of interactions between their meme-infested brains are not at all bound to answer to the interests of their genes alone, or their memes alone. That is our transcendence, our capacity to rebel against the tyranny of the selfish replicators, as Dawkins says. And there is nothing anti-Darwinian or anti-scientific about it. The typical inability of Wilson and other sociobiologists to see their critics as anything but religious fanatics or scientifically illiterate mysterians is yet one more sad overswing of the pendulum. Skinner saw his critics as a bunch of Cartesian dualists and miracle worshippers, and in his peroration he declared, "To man, qua man, we readily say, good riddance. Only by dispossessing him can we turn to the real causes of human behavior. Only then can we turn from the inferred to the observed, from the miraculous to the natural, from the inaccessible to the manipulable. Skinner, 1971, page 201. Wilson and many other sociobiologists have the same bad habit of seeing anybody who disagrees with them as a benighted, science-fearing skyhooker. In fact, only most of the people who disagree with them fit this description. There is a minority comprising reasonable critics of the excesses of greed to which the enthusiastic exponents of any new scientific school are apt to succumb. Another eminent biologist, Richard Alexander, whose own treatment of ethics is much more careful, expresses the appropriate skepticism about Wilson's candidates for cardinal values. Whether or not these goals would all be judged admirable by humanity, Wilson does not connect his selection of them to biological principles. Alexander, 1987, page 167. But Alexander also underestimates the power of culture, memes, to snap Wilson's leash. Like Wilson, he acknowledges the huge difference in speed between cultural and genetic evolution, and argues forcefully, pages 10 through 11, that cultural versatility makes a shamble of any attempts, like Chomsky's and Fodor's, to find some thou shalt go no farther boundary to human cognition. He thinks, however, that evolutionary biology has shown that the individual's self-interests can only be realized through reproduction, by creating descendants and assisting other relatives, and that a consequence of this is that no one ever acts out of genuine beneficence or altruism. As he puts it, this greatest intellectual revolution of the century tells us that, despite our intuitions, there is not a shred of evidence to support this view of beneficence, and a great deal of convincing theory suggests that any such view will eventually be judged false. Alexander, 1987, page 3. But, like Wilson and the social Darwinists, he commits a subtle, attenuated version of the genetic fallacy, and emphasizes the very passage, on page 23, in which he does it. Even if culture changes massively and continually across multiple generations, even if our problems and promises arise out of the cultural process of change, even if there are no genetic variations among humans that significantly affect their behavior, it is always true that the cumulative history of natural selection continues to influence our actions by the set of genes it has provided humanity. This is indeed true, but it does not establish the point he thinks it does. As he insists, no matter how potent cultural forces are, they always have to act on the materials genetic forces have shaped for them and will go on shaping. But they can just as readily redirect or exploit or subvert those genetically endorsed designs as attenuate or combat them. Sociobiologists, overreacting to the cultural absolutists, those crazy skyhookers, in much the way Darwin overreacted to the catastrophists, like to emphasize that culture must have grown out of our biological inheritance. Indeed, it must have. And it is also true that we grew from fish, but our reasons aren't the reasons of fish just because fish are our ancestors. The sociobiologists are also right to stress that our unique capacity to adopt and act on a different set of reasons does not prevent us from being inconvenienced or even tortured or betrayed by our animal urges. Long before Salome did her Dance of the Seven Veils, it was already obvious to members of our species that innate procreative urges can be made to assert themselves at the most inopportune times, just as sneezes and coughs can, seriously threatening the welfare of the body in which those urges are asserted. As in other species, many is the woman who has perished to save her children, and many is the man who has gone to an early death eagerly pursuing one perilous course or another, driven on by the faint hope of procreation. But we must not turn this important fact about our biological limitations into the massively misleading idea that the summum bonum at the source of every chain of practical reasoning is the imperative of our genes. A counterexample shows why not. Larry, heartsick at being spurned by Lola, the love of his life, joins the Salvation Army in order to try to forget her, to put an end to his torment. It works. Years later, St. Larry the Sublimated wins the Nobel Peace Prize for all his good deeds, and Richard Alexander, at the ceremony in Oslo, throws a wet blanket on the proceedings by reminding us that this all grew out of Larry's basic reproductive urges. So it did. So what? We make a big mistake if we think the way to understand the bulk of Larry's life is to try to interpret his every move as designed, one indirect way or another, to ensure that he has grandchildren. The possibility that a meme, or complex of memes, can redirect our underlying genetic proclivities is strikingly illustrated by a 4-century-long human experiment in sociobiology that has recently been vividly drawn to the attention of evolutionary theorists by David Sloan Wilson and Elliot Sober. The Hutterites are a fundamentalist religious sect that originated in Europe in the 16th century and migrated to North America in the 19th century to escape conscription. The Hutterites regard themselves as the human equivalent of a bee colony. They practice community of goods, no private ownership, and also cultivate a psychological attitude of extreme selflessness. Nepotism and reciprocity, the two principles that most evolutionists use to explain pro-social behavior in humans, are scorned by the Hutterites as immoral. Giving must be without regard to relatedness and without any expectation of return. Wilson and Sober, 1994, page 602. Unlike most sects, the Hutterites have been quite successful at propagating their groups over the centuries, enlarging their range and increasing their global population, according to Wilson and Sober. In present-day Canada, Hutterites thrive in marginal farming habitat without the benefit of modern technology, and almost certainly would displace the non-Hutterite population in the absence of laws that restrict their expansion. Page 605. The Hutterites may be over 4 centuries old, but that is no time at all on the genetic calendar. So it is not likely that any of the striking differences between their groups and the groups the rest of us belong to are genetically transmitted. Exchanging Hutterite infants for others would presumably not interfere noticeably with the group fitness of Hutterite colonies. Hutterites simply exploit, thanks to a heritage of cultural transmission, dispositions that are part of the common human stock. So the Hutterites are an example of how cultural evolution can create new group effects. And what is particularly delicious, from an evolutionist's point of view, is their method of fission. Like a honeybee colony, Hutterite brotherhoods split when they attain a large size, with one half remaining at the original site and the other half moving to a new site that has been pre-selected and prepared. In preparation for the split, the colony is divided into two groups that are equal with respect to number, age, sex, skills, and personal compatibility. The entire colony packs its belongings, and one of the lists is drawn by lottery on the day of the split. The similarity to the genetic rules of meiosis could hardly be more complete. Wilson and Sober, 1994, page 604. The Darwinian veil of ignorance in action. But it is not enough all by itself to ensure group solidarity, since human beings, even those who have lived their entire lives in a Hutterite community, are not ballistic intentional systems, but guided intentional systems, and guidance has to be provided on a daily basis. Wilson and Sober quote Ehrenpreis, one of the early leaders of the sect. Again and again we see that man with his present nature finds it very hard to practice true community. They go on to provide further quotations in which Ehrenpreis emphasizes just how explicit and energetic the practices of the Hutterites have to be to counteract this all-too-human tendency. These declarations make it clear that one way or another, Hutterite social organization is the effect of cultural practices quite vigorously arrayed against the very features of human nature Wilson and Sober wish to deny or downplay: selfishness and openness to reasoning. If group thinking were really as much a part of human nature as Wilson and Sober would like to believe, Hutterite parents and elders wouldn't have to say a thing. Compare this to a case in which there truly is a genetic predisposition in our species. How often have you heard parents cajoling their children to eat more sweets? Wilson and Sober are right to present the Hutterite ideals as the essence of an organismic organization. But the big difference is that for people, unlike the cells in our bodies or the bees in a colony, there is always the option of opting out. And that, I would think, is the last thing we want to destroy in our social engineering. The Hutterites disagree, apparently, and so, I gather, do the hosts of many non-Western memes. Do you like the idea of turning ourselves and our children into slaves to the summum bonum of our groups? That is the direction in which the Hutterites have always been headed, and by Wilson and Sober's account, they achieve impressive success, but only at the cost of prohibiting the free exchange of ideas and discouraging thinking for oneself, which is to be distinguished from being selfish. Any stubborn free thinker is brought before the congregation and firmly admonished. If he persists in his stubbornness and refuses to listen even to the church, then there is only one answer to the situation, and that is to cut him off and exclude him. A totalitarian regime, even a group totalitarianism, is extremely vulnerable to dissuasion, in almost exactly the same way an altruistic group is vulnerable to free riders. That is not to say that reason is always on the side of defection. It isn't. It's always on the side of keeping options open, of design revision. This is usually a good thing, but not always. An important fact that has been noted by the economist Thomas Schelling, 1960, the philosopher Derek Parfit, 1984, and others in their discussions of the conditions under which it would be rational for a rational agent to render himself temporarily irrational. For instance, you may want to render yourself a poor target for extortion. If you can somehow convince the world that you are impervious to reason, the world will not try to make you offers you can't refuse. There are circumstances, extreme circumstances, as Wilson and Sober note, when we may reasonably curtail free thinking. But the Hutterites have to discourage free thinking all the time. They have to discourage reading whatever books you want and listening to whomever you want. It is only by the most careful control of the communication channels that such a pristine state can be preserved. That is why the organismic solution is a non-solution to the problems of human society. The Hutterites are thus themselves a curious example of greedy reductionism. Not because they are individually greedy, they are apparently just the opposite, but because their solution to the problem of ethics is so drastically oversimplified. They are, however, an even better example of the power of memes to infect a group of mutual communicators in such a way that the whole group turns its efforts to ensuring the proliferation of those memes at whatever cost to themselves. In the next section, we will look more closely at what sociobiology is and is not, and what it could and could not be. But before we leave the topic of greedy ethical reductionism, we should stop to consider an ancient species of this ill-favored meme with many sub-varieties: religion. If you wanted to give a clear example of the naturalistic fallacy, you could hardly improve on the practice of trying to justify an ethical precept, an ought, by citing as your is. The Bible says so. To this, As to Skinner and Wilson, we must say, so what? Why should the facts, even if they are all facts, recounted in the Bible, or any other holy text, I hasten to add, be supposed to provide any more satisfactory justification for an ethical principle than the facts cited by Darwin in Origin of Species? Now, if you believe that the Bible or some other holy text is literally the Word of God, and that human beings are put here on earth by God in order to do God's bidding, so that the Bible is a sort of user's manual for God's tools, then you do indeed have grounds for believing that the ethical precepts found in the Bible have a special warrant that no other writings could have. If, on the other hand, you believe that the Bible, like Homer's Odyssey, Milton's Paradise Lost, and Melville's Moby Dick, is really a non-miraculous product of human culture, issuing from someone or more human authors, then you will grant it no authority beyond tradition and whatever its arguments generate by their own cogency. This, it should be obvious, is the unchallenged view of philosophers who work in ethics today, so uncontroversial that, if you ever tried to refute a claim in the contemporary ethics literature by pointing out that the Bible said otherwise, you would be met with surprised stares of disbelief. That's just the naturalistic fallacy, the ethicists might say. You can't derive ought from that sort of is. So, do not expect the philosophers to come to your defense if you claim that religion is a source of ethical wisdom that is superior in any way to science. Does that mean that religious texts are worthless as guides to ethics? Of course not. They are magnificent sources of insight into human nature and into the possibilities of ethical codes. Just as we should not be surprised to discover that ancient folk medicine has a great deal to teach modern high-tech medicine, we should not be surprised if we find that these great religious texts hold versions of the very best ethical systems any human culture will ever devise. But like folk medicine, we should test it all carefully and take nothing whatever on faith. Or do you think it is wise to pop those holy mushrooms in your mouth just because some millennia's old tradition declares that they help you see the future? The view I am expressing is what is often called secular humanism. If secular humanism is your bogey person, you shouldn't concentrate all your energy on attacking sociobiologists or behaviorists or academic philosophers, for they are not a fraction of a percent of the influential thinkers who quietly and firmly believe that ethics is not to be settled, but at best guided by religious doctrines. This is indeed the reigning assumption of the U.S. Congress and the courts. Citing the Constitution has more standing than citing the Bible, and so it should. Secular humanism often gets its bad name from self-styled secular humanists who are themselves greedy reductionists of one sort or another. Impatient with the complexities of ancient traditions, disrespectful of the genuine wonders to be savored in the rich cultural heritage of others. If they think that all ethical questions can be boiled down to one definition or a few simple definitions, if it's bad for the environment, it's bad. If it's bad for art, it's bad. If it's bad for business, it's bad. Then they are no better ethicists than Herbert Spencer and the social Darwinists. But when we make the quite appropriate counterclaim that life is more complicated, we must be careful not to turn that into an obstruction of inquiry rather than a plea for more careful inquiry. Otherwise, we put ourselves right back on the forlorn pendulum. What then would a more careful inquiry look like? The task facing us is still the task that faced Hobbes and Nietzsche. Somehow, we have to have evolved into beings that can have a conscience, as Nietzsche says, 1885, Epigram 98, that kisses us while it hurts us. A vivid way of posing the question is to imagine becoming an artificial selector of altruistic people. Like a breeder of domestic cattle, pigeons, or dogs, you could closely observe your herd, noting in a ledger which were naughty and which nice, and, by meddling in various ways, arranging for the nice ones to have more children. In due course, you ought to be able to evolve a population of nice people, supposing that a tendency to niceness could be represented somehow in the genome. We should not think of this as selection for an ethics module that is designed just for giving right answers to ethical questions. Any modules or gadgets might have, singly or in coalition, the effect or byproduct or bonus of favoring the altruistic choices at decision time. After all, the loyalty of dogs to human beings is apparently just such an outcome of unconscious selection by our forebears. God could conceivably have done this for us, but suppose we want to eliminate the middleman and explain the evolution of ethics by natural selection, not artificial selection. Might there be some blind, unforesightful forces, some set of natural circumstances that could accomplish the same thing? Not in one fell swoop, so far as anybody can see. But there are devious, gradual routes by which we might have bootstrapped ourselves into genuine morality by a series of smallish changes. We may begin with parental investment. Trivers, 1972. It is uncontroversial that mutations that yield creatures who invest more energy and time in caring for their young can, under many but not all circumstances, evolve. Remember that only some species engage in parental investment. This is not an option for species in which the young hatch after the parents have died, and the reasons why there should be these fundamentally different parental policies have been well investigated. Now, once parental investment in their own offspring is secured for a species, how do we expand the circle? Singer, 1981. It is just as uncontroversial, thanks to Hamilton's pioneering work, 1964, on kin selection and inclusive fitness, that the same considerations that favor sacrifices for one's offspring also favor, to a mathematically precise degree, sacrifices for one's more distant relatives. Offspring aiding parents, siblings helping each other, aunts helping nephews, and so forth. But again, it is important to remember that the conditions under which such aid is evolutionarily enforceable are not only not universal, but relatively rare. As George Williams, 1988, notes, not only is cannibalism, eating conspecifics, even close relatives, common, but in many species, sibling side, we won't call it murder, since they know not what they do, is almost the rule, not the exception. For instance, when two or more eagle chicks are born in a single nest, the first to hatch is very likely to kill its younger siblings if it can, by pushing the eggs out of the nest, or even pushing the hatchlings out. When a lion acquires a new lioness who is still nursing cubs from an earlier mating, the first order of business is to kill those cubs, so that the lioness will more quickly come into estrus. Chimpanzees have been known to engage in mortal combat against their own kind. And langur monkey males often kill the infants of other males to gain reproductive access to females. Herdy, 1977. So even our closest relatives engage in horrible behavior. Williams points out that, in all the mammalian species that have so far been carefully studied, the rate at which their members engage in the killing of conspecifics is several thousand times greater than the highest homicide rate measured in any American city. This dark message about our furry friends is often resisted, and popular presentations of nature in television documentaries, magazine articles, and popular books often engage in self-censorship to avoid shocking the squeamish. Hobbes was right. Life in the state of nature is nasty, brutish, and short for virtually all non-human species. If doing what comes naturally meant doing what virtually all other animal species do, it would be hazardous to the health and well-being of us all. Einstein famously said, that the dear God is subtle but not malicious. Williams turns that observation inside out. Mother Nature is heartless, even vicious, but boundlessly stupid. And as so often before, Nietzsche finds the point and gives it his special touch. According to nature, you want to live? Oh, you noble Stoics. What deceptive words these are. Imagine a being like nature, wasteful beyond measure, indifferent beyond measure, without purposes and consideration, without mercy and justice, fertile and desolate and uncertain at the same time. Imagine indifference itself as a power. How could you live according to this indifference? Nietzsche, 1885, page 15. Beyond inclusive fitness comes reciprocal altruism, Trivers, 1971, in which non-related or distantly related organisms, they needn't even be of the same species, can form mutually beneficial arrangements of quid pro quo, the first step towards human promise-keeping. It is commonly objected that reciprocal altruism is ill-named, since it isn't really altruism at all, just enlightened self-interest of one form or another. You scratch my back, and I'll scratch yours. Quite literally, in the case of the grooming arrangements that are a favorite simple example, this objection misses the point that we have to pass by small steps to the real McCoy, and reciprocal altruism, ignoble, or just a-noble as it may be, is a useful stepping stone on the progression. It requires advanced cognitive abilities, a rather specific memory capable of re-identifying one's debtors and creditors, and the capacity to spot a cheat, for instance. Moving beyond the most businesslike and brutal forms of reciprocal altruism towards a world in which genuine trust and sacrifice are possible is a task that has begun to be explored theoretically. The first major step was Robert Axelrod's, Axelrod and Hamilton, 1981, Axelrod, 1984, Prisoner's Dilemma Tournaments, which invited all comers to submit strategies, algorithms, for competing against all comers in a reiterated Prisoner's Dilemma Tournament. Among the many discussions of this topic, two of the best are Dawkins, 1989A, Chapter 12, and Poundstone, 1992. The winning strategy became justly famous, tit for tat, which simply copies the opponent's previous move, cooperating in reward for past cooperation, and defecting in retaliation against any defections. Basic tit for tat comes in a variety of subspecies. In nice tit for tat, one begins by cooperating and then just does unto the other as the other has done unto oneself on the previous move. As can be readily seen, two nice tit-for-tatters playing opposite one another make out splendidly, cooperating indefinitely. But a nice tit-for-tatter who encounters a nasty tit-for-tatter who throws in an unprovoked defection at any point is in for a debilitating round of endless retaliatory defection. It serves them both right, of course, as they keep reminding themselves. The simple situations explored by Axelrod's initial tournament have given way to much more complex and realistic scenarios. Nowak and Sigmund, 1993, have found a strategy that outperforms tit-for-tat under an important variety of circumstances. Kitcher, 1993, examines a world of non-compulsory prisoners' dilemma games. If you don't fancy a particular opponent, you can decline to play. Kitcher shows in careful mathematical detail how discriminating altruists, who keep a tally on who has defected in the past, can flourish under certain, not all, conditions, and also begins to sort out the conditions under which varying policies of forgiveness and forgetfulness can hold their own against the ever-present prospect of a resurgence of antisocial types. Particularly fascinating in the directions opened up by Kitcher's analysis is the emergence of groups in which the strong and the weak would tend to segregate themselves and prefer to cooperate with their own sort. Could this set the stage for something like the Nietzschean transvaluation of values? Stranger things have happened. Stephen White, unpublished, has begun to investigate the important further complexities of the multi-person prisoner's dilemma. This is the game that leads to the tragedy of the commons, creating both depleted fish stocks in our oceans and forests of tall trees. As Kitcher points out, the simple scenarios are analytically tractable. The equations of interaction and their expected yields can be solved directly by mathematical calculation. But as we add more realism and, hence, complexity, the direct solution of the equations becomes unfeasible. So we have to turn to the indirect methods of computer simulation. In such a simulation, you just set up hundreds or thousands of imaginary individuals, endow them with dozens or hundreds or thousands of strategies or other properties, and let the computer do all the work of having them play thousands or millions of games against each other, keeping track of the results. This is a branch of sociobiology or evolutionary ethics that no one should deride. It directly tests the hunches, such as those of Hobbes and Nietzsche, that there are natural, evolutionarily enforceable paths to where we are today. We may be quite sure that this is true, for here we are. But what this research promises to clarify is how much R&D work of what sorts was required to get us here. At one extreme, it could turn out that there is an impressive bottleneck. A quite improbable but crucial series of happy accidents were required. White's analysis offers some plausible reasons for believing that the conditions are really quite stringent. At the other extreme, it might turn out that there is a rather wide basin of attraction that will lead almost any cognitively sophisticated creatures, whatever their circumstances, into societies with recognizable ethical codes. It will be fascinating to see what large-scale computer simulations of these complex social interactions tell us about the constraints on the evolution of ethics. But we can already be virtually certain that mutual recognition and the capacity to communicate a promise, stressed by both Hobbes and Nietzsche, are necessary conditions for the evolution of morality. It is conceivable, if unlikely on present evidence, that whales and dolphins, or the great apes, meet these necessary conditions. But no other species come close to exhibiting the sorts of social cognition that true morality depends on. My pessimistic hunch is